Welcome to Driven to Business with your host, Eddie Mayfield. Driven to Business is a business forum program that focuses on success principles in business. And now, it's time for Driven to Business.
Morning. Welcome to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. Glad you're here. We're going to talk a little today about booms, and busts. And I'm not sure the correct way to pronounce that, busts in business. And not just the fact that booms and busts do occur, but the fact that you can make money on both sides of that in business if you're careful in what you do. I'll tell you give you a little history story here first. And the point of this is not to just to give you some history, but we're going to make a point out of it. But I hope it's interesting to start with. Any of you have ever read any of Jack London's books, like White Fang or some of those things, are a little bit familiar with this. But back in the late 1800s, in fact, in 1896, up in the Yukon area, there were two Indians who had the interesting name of Skookum Jim Mason and another guy named Taglish Charlie, and they had an American from Seattle named George Carmack with them. They found gold in a small creek outside of Dawson in the Yukon Territory up there, and they renamed the creek Bonanza Creek. And almost instantly, all of the locals up there ran down and set out claims to the gold there in that creek. And it really was an amazing find. And in fact, a lot of the early stakeholders became known as Klondike Kings, and they were extremely wealthy. Over $1 billion worth of gold ended up coming out in today's money. Ended up coming out of that creek. But of course, this was back in the late 1800s, and it was so remote up there, it was a year before anyone else really heard of it. But about a year later, a freighter called the Portland arrived in Seattle and had over a ton of gold aboard, which even before the days of social media and Fox News and all and cable TV like we have now, the word of that spread very quickly. The newspaper there, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, printed it, and the gold rush was on. And what's amazing to me, within 6 months, there were over 100,000 people started heading for the Yukon. Now, this was in 1897. This was long before there was any good methods of transportation up there. And in fact, that was one of the problems they ran into. Of that 100,000 that left, only about 30,000 of them actually made it up there. It was that hard. A lot of them died on the way. A lot of them just went dead broke getting up there and just found it so hard that they could not get up there. Vicki and I have been on to Skagway in Alaska, which is where a lot of this started, and it's where the White Pass Trail originates. And some of the movies you may have seen of the people coming up the Klondike, where they're all standing in line, trudging up this mountain in single file with just loaded down with equipment on their backs and dragging sleds of equipment. That's where this took place. And there's a railroad now that runs up that trail. You can actually get on it now and ride it up. But back in those days, there was not a railroad. And the people that started up there, it was really hard. It was most of these people were from the lower 48. They were not used to the weather up there by any stretch of imagination. A lot of people froze to death. You can imagine they got frostbite on their appendages and so forth, so they would lose fingers and so forth. Medical care was almost non-existent. A lot of them starved to death because there was not food to eat. In fact, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, the Mounties, because of so many people dying from starvation, began to impose some very, very harsh restrictions on people coming into British Columbia. The Yukons are coming into Canada, actually. Later became British Columbia, coming into Canada, and said they had to have a year's supply of food with them. Now, think about that. You're hoofing up there by yourself, and you've got to carry a year's supply of food. Imagine what that was like to get up there. Well, that was required to get in there. And as you might imagine, in this towns of Skagway, there was also another trail besides the White Pass Trail. There was a trail called the Chilcook Trail that originated in Haines, what's now Haines, Alaska, which is right by there. But it was actually a much steeper trail than even the White Pass was, and not much easier. In the town of Skagway there, if you go through, it's an interesting place to go through. The town really was run by this con man named Soapy Smith. That's what he was called. And Soapy and a gang of about 300 guys, they made a living really just fleecing these Klondikers, the people come getting off the boats there, to come up in there and go find the gold. And one of his more notorious scams he did was he put up what looked like telegraph poles leading out of town. But of course, in that remote area of the world, you could not, in that day and age, it would have been pretty much impossible to get a telegraph line actually in there because of the mountains it was surrounding it. So he just ran the poles out of town, and then he charged the Klondikers up there to send telegrams home, when in fact there were no telegraph lines. He was just charging them. But anyway, that's what happened to a lot of the people there. The point is this: very few of those people that went up there, it basically by taking all their life savings and everything and putting their lives at risk, and many of them did lose their lives and everything else, very few of those people made a nickel up there chasing the gold. Very few. But yet billions were taken out of there in gold. But who got it? Well, the people that got it were, for the most part, the first people that were there. The people that were already in Dawson, they became fabulously wealthy. The other people that made money, Soapy Smith notwithstanding, not all of them were crooks, but a lot of them were the people that were selling goods and services to the Klondikers that were going up there. That's who made the money. In fact, it was a fairly famous guy. His name was Frederick Drumpf. He was a German immigrant who set up a hotel and a restaurant along the trail there to feed people. He made a fortune there. He changed his name to Trump and moved to New York and got into the real estate business there. And that's Donald Trump's grandfather. That's where the Trump money came from. It started there on the Klondike, getting it up. There's a couple of lessons to learn out of that. Again, I told you that was a history lesson, but it's not strictly a history lesson. But the first lesson out of that is that when a boom occurs, when you see a boom happening, the first people to get involved in the boom make most of the money in the boom. The second thing is, all booms end. Now, I used to work for a couple of guys out in Texas that were into the oil business quite a bit. And they used to tell me that about the oil business, that you need to make your money while it's good, while it's going well, but always have in the back of your mind that booms do not last. It will dive, and be prepared when it dives. And it's amazing to me how people, even with that simple advice, where they don't heed that advice. So the first people in make most of the money. All booms in. Much, if not most, and I would probably guess it leans toward the most. Most of the money made around a boom is in people supplying materials and services to the boom. That's certainly true in the oil business, and it's true in many other things. I used to have a friend out in Texas who used to tell me that when you hear an oil field is producing so many barrels of oil per day, you want to be in the barrel business. You want to be in the business of supplying the barrels that handle that oil. You know, there's a lot of things that are just that don't seem intuitive, that are factual. A couple of things that I learned in my service experience and working in and around industrial plants. Used to work for a company that made metallized film. And without going into what that is, that when you buy a potato chip bag, you're buying when you open the bag up, the inside of the bag actually has aluminum on it. It's an interesting process to make that happen in an industrial sense. That bag, that potato chip bag, cost more than the potato chips that are in the bag. Now, we don't think about that too much, but that's a fact. You know, when you drink a can of Coke, the can costs more than the Coke. Now, that doesn't make sense, does it? Except from a marketing standpoint, because I actually asked a guy with him, why do you do this? Does this keep potato chips fresher or something? And he said, not really. You could do it. You could keep them fresh in less attractive packaging, but the attractive packaging, people buy it. Again, it's a matter of supplying. It's the way we're all built. It's a matter of supplying what people want. And remember, we've talked many times over here, most buying decisions are emotional, not rational. So again, you have to deal with it. Well, if you're looking around to supply goods and services to a boom, you need to know that. You know, I'm told by a lot of people in the restaurant business that the most profitable item they sell in a restaurant when they're serving meals is either going to be the desserts or the coffee or the tea. And you think about it. If you go somewhere and you pay $3.50 for in a nice restaurant, you pay $3.50 for a glass of tea, and they're going to refill it. So that seems like quite a bargain, right? What do you think the tea cost them to put in there? I almost bet you that it costs them about as much to wash that glass as the tea cost them. Putting in it. It may well be the iced cost, the ice they're putting in there, the fact that they're probably making their own ice, costs as much as that tea. A lot of profit in it. And so when they come out and upsell you on a additional cup of coffee or something, that may be, or dessert, that could well be, that's the majority of their profit on that meal. And I'm not knocking them for doing that. I'm just saying that that's kind of the way it is. So what do you, if you're going to provide services and so forth to someone in a boom, what is that going to look like? Well, in the oil fields, for instance, you can kind of go up, and we're going to talk about that in the next segment. You can actually go up and downstream a little bit of the oil business. Perhaps you are able to supply, perhaps you have, if you're just looking to work as a one-man show, maybe you have skilled labor that you could sell to someone hunting for oil, for instance. So you have the labor to your great electrician or your great mechanic or something of that sort. Well, those are skills you can sell in that business without actually investing in the oil, but you can make a pretty good living for yourself by supplying a service to the people that are looking for oil. You know, oil, even in today's world, oil is a speculative thing. You know, not every well they drill finds oil or gas. That's something that I used to be sort of amazed by that when I used to work more in the oil fields out in Texas, was the idea that they would spend hundreds of thousands of dollars drilling offshore, could be $1 million, drilling for oil, not really 100% certain there was oil down there. Now, they do a lot. There is a lot of science involved in this, a lot of seismic testing. Technology is so much advanced over what it used to be. In that regard, we're going to talk about that advanced technology a little more in the next segment. But nonetheless, there's a lot of speculation and risk. But think about it. I mean, if you're an electrical company, and you have a little electrical company, and you're supplying electrical services to them, what is your risk? Well, your only risk is that they're going to go out of business. You're going to get paid for your electrical services, whether they find oil there or not. And so who has the better deal here? Well, that's why a lot of folks will say, you know, sell the barrels, sell the services to that industry if you don't have the capital or the means to actually get in there and dig it up. You're listening to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. By the way, podcast on eddiemayfield.com worldwide and streaming live on biz1190.com. See you in a minute. Welcome back to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. Glad you're here. We're talking about doing business in boom and bust cycles and how you can make business on both sides of that curve if you pay attention to what you're doing. It is all about, though, understanding and paying attention. I want to talk to you about the oil business just a little bit because it's a hugely important business in American commerce. In fact, in worldwide commerce, I can't think of a commodity that probably has more direct effect on economies than does oil. And if you follow the news at all, you know that oil recently has taken some wild ride. It's up and down. I've got several reasons I think we'll talk about that. But let me give you a little overview of the oil industry. Some of you may not know this. Generally, you divide the oil drilling and the oil industry in sort of three major areas. You've got drilling, production, and oil field services. And we talk about upstream and downstream in the oil business. Upstream is like going back up toward the well and where you know they're actually pumping the black stuff out of the ground and drilling holes and hunting it and all that. Downstream is where it gets to refineries, pipelines, distribution centers, to your gas station finally where you buy gas or the natural gas that's coming into your house to heat your house. That's the downstream side of it. And while they're the same industry, there's a lot of different players in all the levels along there. And in the drilling industry, the drilling part of it is probably what a lot of people do think about when they think about oil. By the way, there's a website you can go to called rigzone.com, and you can find a lot of it. And it's actually a very specialized website. It's actually a pretty user-friendly, good website. It's where guys in the oil field go to find jobs. Frankly, it's one thing you do there in the drilling industry. And they'll have a lot of information on there about what rigs are operating, who's hiring, who's not, where they are, things of that sort. But even drilling rigs are broken down a little bit. You've got land rigs. That's kind of that most of us out in Texas used to see. And basically, it's a drilling rig. It's on land. They'll drill everywhere from anywhere from, well, I don't know, 3 to 10,000 feet is probably common. You do find some specialized rigs that will go down to 30,000 feet, so forth. There are submersible rigs, and these are used for like deep ocean type of oil exploration. It's a little more, it's quite a bit more complex. A very common rig in the Gulf of Mexico is called a jackup, and basically what it is, you'll see these. You can go to Mobile or New Orleans or along Louisiana coast to Houston, places like this. You'll see them tied up, and these are rigs that have these hydraulically operated legs, and basically they go out, they just by using hydraulics push the legs down in the water, basically jack the rig up, that's what you look at, and make the rig stand on the bottom, and that's another way they do it. You also have, for extremely deep water, they have what's called drill ships. Now these are very, very complex, very expensive ships that have all kind of very extensive positioning systems to hold them exactly still while they're drilling down. And get that down. In the production side of it, you end up with these are people that are actually getting the oil out of the hole. It's already been drilled. It's been settled. There's usually it's connected to a pipeline or some other kind of a collection type system. These are people who are using pumps, and there's people that operate them. And it may be an outsourced operation type thing, or it may actually be owned by the field may be owned by somebody like Exxon or something like that. It's also not uncommon at all. As I said, that they're outsourcing that, and somebody else owns, or an individual landowner even owns this production field, or at least owns the wells in there, and they have some contractor, some company that whose reason for existence is to manage that field, and they they employ technicians, mechanics, engineers, electrical guys that go around and be sure that all the equipment's operating and the oil is coming out of the ground. And also to see how much oil is coming out, because they get charged, by how much they pump out of there. So they're paying attention to all of this. And then you have oil field services as almost sort of separate ancillary business. There are people in oil field services, like their jobs are to, there are companies that do seismic things. They go out and do seismic. You heard of fracking? Well, there are companies that do, they're fracking companies. You have an oil well, you need it to be fracked. You call these people, they come in, bring the necessary equipment, they frack the well, and they employ all sorts of people. Again, they even subcontract, again, as an entrepreneurial type situation. They subcontract everything from software to electrical services to transporting their equipment around. I mean, there's all sorts of ways of getting that done. The main point there of that is that you can take what happens in the oil industry and you can sort of play that over into anything else. There are a lot of, right here in Atlanta, there are a lot of large buildings that are owned by certain corporations, and some of them are local here in the States. Some of them are actually overseas, like in Japan or China or somewhere like that. But those buildings are managed. They actually employ another company to manage those buildings. And there are a number of very large property management companies here in Atlanta. So again, it's this whole thing about you're supplying, again, to use the oil field analogy, you're supplying the barrels to the oil industry. You're not really supplying the oil. Well, you don't actually own this building. You are, however, managing this building for somebody. That's an entire industry. And all through that, all through that, again, there are building engineers. Those building engineers outsource work to mechanics and cleaning services all sorts of repair people and painters and carpenters and all this, all that come in and do that. And again, it generates an entire industry, and particularly for those of us in small business, these are opportunities that you find. And so when you see that a real estate boom's going on, and yet I'm not really in the real estate business, if you have skills that can be used in the, not to go too far with this oil analogy, but in the downstream side of real estate, in other words, in the management side of those properties, well, say you're a good electrical person or you own a janitorial company or you are a carpenter or whatever, that's where you go in and see how you can do that. Now, let's think about it a minute about the, and I'm going to talk about the next segment, the idea of, bad times can also be good times for people supplying services. And we're going to talk about that in a little bit. It's not intuitive. Our company, EMA, we have traditionally, I'm not wishing bad times on anybody, but at least in our 25-year history, we've actually, in terms of services, done a little better when the economy is a little soft. And I can tell you the reasons for that in just a few minutes. Other services you might think about, all sorts of specialized services like you know, if you know something about an industry that's booming, let's say you're not directly in it, but you know a lot about it, or you know a lot about perhaps some kind of software they need to be using, or you're good at marketing particular things, or something like that, well, you can get involved with them as a consultant and even a teacher. We do at our company. We do a lot of work teaching webinars and seminars to people on electronic motor drives and problems that are often associated or come along with electronic motor drives, such as people that are having perhaps harmonic issues or electrical harmonic issues with large motors, things of that sort. Also, predictive maintenance on things. You know, these are things that we can come in and teach somebody, and we do it. One thing you need to always do if you're doing that, always teach those courses with an idea of what they can benefit from it, not from what you can benefit from it. Absolutely. Be sure that the person you're teaching it to. We do some of these as a marketing situation for at no cost at all to the prospect or customer. Others, we actually get paid to come in and do this. And so, again, it would depend on your business, what you do. You know, if you really stop and think about it, if you're an attorney, attorneys really are really just specialized services that these companies need. You know, these companies, like our company, we're not in the legal business. So if I have legal things to be done, I'm not in that business. I don't know anything about it. So I, in essence, outsource that. Well, you outsource it to a professional attorney. The same thing for CPAs, all those kinds of things. There are all sorts of entrepreneurial activities you can do if you can provide a service that they can't be doing well themselves. One that pops up that we use pretty often that I think a lot more people ought to think about than do is courier services. You know, there are times, we run into this in our business, where we've got somebody that's down, they need a piece of equipment or a drawing or something, and they need it right, they need it now. And let's say they're in Ohio. Well, we can go next day, FedEx or something like that, but it doesn't work. So we'll actually pay some guy to put it in his car and drive it up there. There's a whole industry that does that and make pretty good money doing it. We'll talk more about that in the next segment. I'm Eddie Mayfield. You're listening to Driven to Business. Boom and bust. Back in a minute. Welcome back to Driven to Business. We're talking about doing business in bad times and in good times, or as we have talked a little bit about, when an industry or an economy goes through a boom cycle and a bust cycle. You can't, you know, if you've got a business and the industry that you serve or you're involved in goes bust, most of us cannot just take our marbles and go home, because we got our marbles heavily invested in that business. And so we're going to have to, I don't want to mix all my symbols up here, but you're going to have to make lemonade out of lemons or whatever. I don't know the right way to put that, but you got to roll with the punches and do it. You know, bad times can be good for service companies if you can provide services. And here's why. In our industry that where we do, electronic motor drive service and repair for industrial plants, among other things, when those plants get into trouble, and when, let's say, their corporate leadership tells them to reduce staff, well, some of the people they may lay off. This is not necessarily the smartest thing they could do, but it's what they do. They may lay off maintenance workers, because, you know, it costs a lot of money to keep a full-time employee employed, particularly in today's litigious world where your benefits and everything cost a ton of money. So they will lay off a worker, and it's cheaper to use us, although they're paying us a lot more per hour than they're paying that worker. They don't use us 40 hours a week. They use us much less. And again, they are paying us no benefits or anything. So, you know, once they use us for, you know, a week or 2 days or whatever amount of time they're using us, and then we send them a bill, well, that's it. Until the next time they use us, they have no ongoing issues with us. The other thing, that's not just true in the maintenance field. It's also true in things like clerical. If you're a bookkeeper type, there are a lot of companies that are not employing that many people. Where a lot of folks have made entrepreneurial money, and this is in the software side of things, where a lot of small and medium-sized companies do not want to employ full-time IT people. They really can't, because, you know, if you're a smaller, medium-sized company, you may have no need of a full-time IT person, but when you need IT work, you really, really, really do need it. And so if you can provide those kinds of services and make yourselves available, it's a great time. And many times in down economies, you know, they can afford to be down less. You know, one thing to think about, if you've got a company that's experiencing a down time, and they've got an order they can't ship to a customer because of a computer glitch, or that's a big, big, big deal to them. And so they are going to have you come out there and do it. They may also, in terms of taking care of old equipment, again, I tend to think that way. Instead of expending capital on new equipment, they may keep their old equipment going. Now, if you're a maintenance type person or you do carpentry work, instead of moving in a new building, perhaps they just need to fix up the building they're in. Or you can see people that even works with people's houses. You know, instead of moving, perhaps they'll decide, well, you know, I'm going to fix my house up because times are a little tough here for us. Again, if you're providing those kinds of services, a downtime can really be a good time for you. And the other thing is they may, if they're worried about competition and they're really having to work hard, they may be more open to newer technologies and newer and more efficient ways of doing things than they were in the past. Because they say, you know, if I can, instead of having five people doing this, if I can use a new technology here and use one person to do it, those are the kinds of things that are really good. You know, one of the things that modern technology has done is and by that I'm talking about the internet primarily, and all the fallout from the internet, which would be, you know, things like Twitter, Facebook, Google, email, all that, you name it. One of the things that has done is level the ground for smaller companies. You know, years ago, a small company had a really, really, really tough time competing with a big company. How are you going to do that? You do not have their, you can't put 200 salespeople out on the street like they can. You can't do the bulk mailing they're doing. You can't afford the big glossy ads and all the magazines they do. You can't afford to run advertisements on national television like they can. You can't do any of that. So how do you get your name out there? Well, you were stuck with things like, oh, the Yellow Pages. And I'm not even knocking that. That was for a lot of people providing consumer type services. The Yellow Pages was a great thing at one time. When's the last time you knew anybody that looked at a Yellow Page? That doesn't happen much anymore. But boy, the internet has made it different, hasn't it? It's made it worldwide. You know, you can sit in your house now and literally advertise around the world and grab things up like that. You know, one of the ways you can do that, and we talked about it on here on our program a number of times, you can use what's available to you to use that really cost almost nothing. Things like LinkedIn, Twitter, blogs. I'm a big pusher of blogs. Blogs make such a difference. You can actually become well-known in an industry if you have knowledge and expertise in an industry and you're able to write it. You know what? If you can't write, what I was talking about earlier, hire somebody that can. You can go find you some English major. Give them, you know, sit down with a yellow notepad and tell them the points you want to make and have them make it sound nice. There's all sorts of ways to do this. And put blogs up there. And learn a little bit how to write a blog, so make it search engine friendly. You need to make it also reader friendly, where the readers will read it, and make it search engine friendly. I've been astonished in our business how much business we've done from people finding us through blogs. Because, you know, there's a great thing about that. If you're writing about a specific little niche in business that you're an expert on, and somebody is looking for that, well, they're much more likely to be looking much harder in that little niche area you're in, and there they see your blog, and then there you are. And then what you got to do then is be sure that you've done all the things. Like, be very easy to find. Don't be confusing. Be easy to do business with. When they do call you, make sure you do follow up and all this, you get back with them. But it really has done a great, great, great job. The other thing is, once you establish yourself as an expert in things, as we had mentioned here earlier, you can do seminars or in this day and age, webinars and things of that sort. You can do trade shows. But you know what's a better deal than doing a trade show? It's much better to be invited to speak at a trade show. Do you know that? If you can get to be an expert enough to be asked to speak at a trade show, and blogs can open the door for you right there, be able to do that. Be able to do that. That absolutely works out. Now, again, a caution here I always do. If you're speaking somewhere, say you get invited to speak at an industry trade show that has something to do with the business you're in, whatever it is, be absolutely certain when you go there to speak that the people you're thinking about are the people there, not you. Be sure that you don't get up there and give them some sales pitch. I've seen people do this, and I'll tell you, people will get up and walk out. They will not take it well. Be sure that you do a presentation that is interesting to the people that came there, things that they want to hear. And it's where they can, you're doing great if they can make notes. In fact, help them make notes. Have a handout and give them something to take home. Of course, at the bottom of it, you have your contact information. But make the big print, stuff that is interesting to them. You will find yourself all of a sudden building relationships and having people call you. And let me tell you, in a business, it is so much better if prospects are calling you rather than you calling them. And again, I'm all about sales and calling people. That's fine. And we do a lot of that, and you need to be doing that if you're not doing it. But boy, it's a better deal when they are calling you. When you've done marketing, to put yourself out there, whether you sort of hit a nerve out there with people that want something done and they're calling you to talk to you about doing it, you are miles ahead of your competition at that point that you're able to do that with. You know, one of the things, back to the oil field just a minute, and this is something that I think is a truism through in business. One of the oil business right this moment is, if you keep up with this at all, the price of oil is dropping. Now, exactly when the show airs, there's no telling what the price of oil will be because it's very volatile. It's up and down all over the place right now. But generally speaking, there's a bit of a glut of oil. Now, how did we get to a glut of oil? Well, one of the ways we got there is a very good way. It's much improved technology. We are so much better at technology. Things like fracking, horizontal drilling, and if we have time in the program, I'll talk to you more about that. Things like that have just made wells that would not have been producible all of a sudden producing it. And by the way, I've never bought into the theory of what's called peak oil. You heard this several years ago. We're about to run out of oil and blah, blah, blah. No, we're not. That was before we learned how to really find oil. It's the oil and gas reserves we have in the United States are, I wouldn't want to say inexhaustible, but they're going to go centuries from now, even at present usage. So the argument that we're running out of oil is a silly argument and made by people that don't know anything about the industry. But you know, the very idea that this glut happened, part of it, again, was the fact that technology got really good. But, you know, when prices go down, generally speaking, you slow down the supply in order to get prices back up. But here's why that didn't happen. It's because of the incredible availability of cheap credit that was put out there, to where they were not paying the real cost of money, what it was taking to drill these wells, finish the wells, get everything online. The cheap money sort of masked the problem. Now, many of you don't know anything about the oil industry. I think I can put this over in a area that you are aware of. One of the problems I think we have right now in this country is it's too easy to get a college loan. I know that may fly in the face of what some of you think, but it's way too easy to get a college loan. And that's why you find people going to college and majoring in inane things that they're never going to make a living doing, and they shouldn't even be in college with that idea. I'm very much of the opinion that for most people, and people are different, individuals are different, for most people, it would be better if you got out of high school and stayed out of high school for a year or two and worked and got a little bit of real life experience before you just show up and pretend to be College Joe and start declaring majors in an area when you have no clue what you're doing. You don't even know what you like to do. You don't know what you're skilled at doing. You have no idea, for a lot of people. And you're able to do that by the cheap availability of college loans. And the problem is those college loans one day become due. And you come out of college with a degree where you can't make a living using that degree, and yet you owe a ton of money. It's a bad situation. Again, I think that's also fueled, the cheap college loans have fueled the incredible inflation in college tuition. It has outstripped almost everything else in society in terms of the increase in college cost. And that's, again, because of cheap money. I know, so those of you that are parents, I think we've got kids on college loans, probably may find that kind of hard to swallow. But one of the best things you might be able to do to your kid is tell them to stop borrowing money to go to college. Get a job for a year. Get out. See what you really want to do in college. And then if you need to borrow money, go back and do it. Honestly, if you can possibly do it by working your way through and not borrowing money, you're so much better off than the other people coming out of there. Because, you know, you want to buy a house. You want to get married. You want to buy a house. You want to buy cars, all these kinds of things. And yet you really can't do that because you are stuck really hard paying back a loan that you shouldn't have taken in the first place. And, again, it's the same thing in many other industries. Cheap money as fuel thing. You know, economic hard times, I've said this many times to myself and to other people, economic hard times often force us to do things we should have done when the economic times are not hard. That's been true in my business. That's probably true in your business. You're listening to Driven to Business. Remind you again, we're streaming live on biz1190.com. Podcast on eddiemayfield.com and iTunes. Back in a minute. Mm-hmm. Welcome back to the final segment of today's Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. Glad you're here. We're talking about doing business in boom and bust cycles, good and hard times, things of that sort. I don't want to be naive about this. Many of you have suffered extremely hard times in your business. In fact, most of us that have been in business have had bad years. You know, when I first started a business, I would have to kind of calm myself down a little bit because we would have a good month, and I would just be so happy I could hardly sleep. This is the idea that we'd had a good month, and I was just ecstatic about it and just kind of giddy. And then the next month, we would have a bad month, and I could hardly sleep because I was so upset about it, and you're walking around, you know, we're all going broke, we're all going to die, blah, blah, that kind of thing. Well, you know, as I've gotten a little older and hopefully a little more mature, actually I've gotten a lot older and I hope a little more mature, I've sort of stopped taking those short-term views of things. You've got to sort of take, you hear the saying all the time, life's a marathon, not a sprint, and it is. You've got to sort of back it off a little bit. Don't get quite so happy when things are good. I mean, rejoice at it. Celebrate. If you make your goals for a month, celebrate. You know, at EMA, at our company, if we make our billing goals at either one of our offices, what we do is we give all our employees extra paid time off as a reward because we want them to all, you know, enjoy the fact that we made our monthly goals. And we set those goals and get up there, and you should do things like that. You should celebrate everything, but don't go nuts about it because, you know, you can have a great month this month. If you've never had a bad month in business, you're going to. I've never met anybody that doesn't hit the wall once in a while. It's just going to happen to you. So how do you get going with it? Again, let's go back and let's talk about what I started off the program here, talking about this thing in the Yukon, the idea that this giant gold boom took place in the Yukon in the late 1800s, and there were people who got fabulously wealthy from it. A whole ton of gold arrives down in Seattle on a steamer. The word gets out, and everybody in the world, 100,000 people. And you keep in mind what the population of the country was back then. That would be the equivalent of a lot more people now. Probably a million people now. That suddenly, by every way they could get there, started showing up at the Yukon. Most of them completely unprepared for what they were doing, had no idea what they were doing. And consequently made no money out of it. And in the beginning, people made money out of it. And the only people that made money after that were the people that were supplying the people that were rushing up there to take advantage of that. There's a great lesson in business here. Again, as I always say, that sort of ties to an oil analogy. If you sell the barrels, be in the barrel business. For most of us, that's great. That's great advice for it. And let me tell you something else that's a generally just sort of an investment strategy of mine and a bit of a business strategy. When everybody else hates a business, sometimes a business you should be thinking about. I'll give you a great example of that here. Very recently, the coal industry in the United States right now is a hated industry. The Obama administration, I'm not making this up, they said it themselves, they declared war on the coal industry. And so the coal industry in the United States is really suffering. And so you would think that if you were going to do anything around the coal industry or you're going to make any investments in the coal industry, this would be the time to run from that like the plague. But you know, one of the richest guys in the world, and regardless of what you may think about this guy politically or anything, he knows how to make money. His name is George Soros, just bought huge amounts of coal stocks, buying coal. Now, why would he do that? Well, because number one, the fact that it's hated pushed the prices down in that industry. But the real truth of the matter is, even though the prices were down, coal is still one of the most used commodities on earth to provide energy. And it's not changing anytime soon. And so now, I'm not suggesting you go out and buy coal. I didn't tell you that story to encourage you to do that. What I'm saying is, look, just because everybody else is running away from something in business doesn't mean you should run from it. You should look at the real truth there. Don't be so emotional about it. I'll give you one. This is not quite the same example, but it's a business no one thinks about, but it's one of the most profitable and growing businesses in the United States, and that has to do with wastewater treatment. In fact, water in general, water treatment, you know, there's two sides of that coin. There's a clean water treatment, all of which of us, we want clean water coming out of our taps. And not to be too crude about it, but generally speaking, most of the water comes out of your tap is going to end up in your sewer. In one way or another. And so there's two sides of that coin. There's a side that treats the water, and there are water shortages in many parts of the United States. Many of you are aware of that. So there are business opportunities there. if you can serve those industries. And the wastewater, although it's a hated industry, nobody wants to be around it, everybody don't want to talk about it, be there, that's a booming industry. There is no pullback in those industries. Now, you will find they're owned by municipalities and state governments and things like that, and they may be in some trouble about being able to spend capital money that they would like to spend to expand this or that or the other. Let me tell you something. They're not going to let that wastewater treatment station shut down. Can you imagine, even right here in our county, if in Gwinnett County, Fulton County, the Cobb County, the surrounding areas here in the Atlanta area, Henry County, they have huge infrastructures built up around treating waste. Thank goodness. I mean, that's one reason here in the United States we have such a fabulous water system, and why we have such a, you can drink water out of your faucet here in this country, and you can't do that in a lot of countries. And one of the reasons is that we treat wastewater very well in this country. There's very advanced technology to do that. But it's a booming business. And again, those are the kind of businesses that perhaps you think of something in that you can do, and it's a business you should chase. Because here's wouldn't you rather be chasing a growing business than a dying business? Well, of course you would. And even though everybody else may run from it because they don't like it, maybe something you ought to think about getting into and getting done. You know, our company, we've done pretty well over the years in serving hated industries such as, dirty industries like we would call it, like wastewater thing. We do business all over the United States, as a matter of fact, in wastewater. We fly all over taking care of their large horsepower motors and drives and things that power and pump these treatment facilities, all of which are very necessary. I'll promise you, nobody in the town wants to hear their wastewater is shut down. And on the clean water side, nobody wants to hear that a water treatment station is shut down, because think about that. How much storage do they have? Well, I can tell you, not very much. They really need those stations to be treated and running. And again, those are things you can make money doing if you are able to supply services to those industries that are critical and needed. And back to the oil just for a minute. You know, right here in the Atlanta area, we have a headquarters. We're a major terminus here in Atlanta, what's called the midstream market. And that has to do with oil and gas pipelines that come right through Atlanta and turn and go up the East Coast. They come from Texas for the most part, go up the East Coast. It used to be that all the gas and oil flowed out of Texas through here and went north. Well, now with the oil and gas finds, particular gas finds in Pennsylvania and that area up there, some of that gas now comes back south, and we're in many of our homes here, we're burning gas that came out of Pennsylvania, for instance, instead of out of Texas where it was before. We also have here in town a large refined product pipeline where most of your gas that you put in your car here in the Atlanta area comes from. And in fact, a great deal of the gas on the East Coast, the entire East Coast and the Gulf Coast of the United States, comes out of that pipeline. So it's very needed business. Again, those are businesses that are kind of stealth and they're out there. And while I don't think there's any business that's completely inflation-proof, you know what? If the price of oil goes down, think about it a minute. If you're pumping, if the price of natural gas goes down, and are you going to use less natural gas or more natural gas? You're probably going to use more by supplies of law and demand. So if you're a pipeline company, think about that a minute, and you're supplying, you're getting paid for how many cubic feet of that gas you put through your pipeline. Is your business hurting any? The answer is no. These guys are doing quite, the price of oil and gas can go down. These guys do very well in that business. Again, knowing those kinds of things, looking at booms and busts and seeing which side you can make money when a business is expanding. If you play your cards right, you can make money when they're going down. I hope it's been helpful to you. I'm Eddie Mayfield. You've been listening to Driven to Business. We're here every Saturday morning right here in Atlanta's Biz 1190. A reminder again, we'll be podcast on eddiemayfield.com. You can contact me at eddie@eddiemayfield.com. See you next week.
You've been listening to Driven to Business with your host, Eddie Mayfield. Visit next Saturday at 11 a.m. on Biz 1190 for more Driven to Business. To learn more about Driven to Business, visit eddiemayfield.com or call 770-448-4644.